This machine over here is the one we talked about earlier. This is the one that was resurrected or rescued.
Oh, this is the one with bullet holes, so you can see the bullet holes.
This is Gene Andall's PhD dissertation. Yeah. Okay, so here was a frustrated physicist that wanted to recognize that he had to do more computation if he wanted to proceed in physics. Yeah. And this is what he took on for his PhD dissertation.
Now, this is sort of the beginning of Silicon Valley as well, right? Did Gene do his work out here, or did he do his work in Boston?
Wisconsin,
okay.
Right. No, I mean, Gene was significant in terms of the way when he brought the project out, the IBM project out from IBM on the East Coast, and he was, I'd say, instrumental in bringing sort of large machine design and silicon design, gate-array silicon design, to the valley.
And this is the sage that Gordon talked about earlier.
Yeah, this was the evolution. This is what the whirlwind evolved into, and there were like 20 of these in various parts of Canada, and this was the early warning system. So each of these had radars connected to them. They communicated together. So here's one of the first network machines.
Yeah.
Come on down here so we can get a shot of you.
52,000 vacuum tubes in this. 53,000
vacuum tubes.
Okay.
Right,
vacuum
and so you're just looking at a very small section of it.
How big? Now, this the computer, when it was fully built, would take up what, half this room, or?
Probably no. I'd say the whole room.
The full room.
These were buried. This one came from a hole 600 feet underground at North Bay, Canada, and the air conditioning, just the air conditioning for it was power plant that was in there was enormous. I mean, I remember when we went to pick it up, we got it and we wanted to see it in its habitat. We picked it up, and in the room where all the consoles and everything is, there were two huge computers, two mini computers sitting there, two racks that replaced all of this.
Yeah. And what's really fun about this thing, take a look at this console over here, Bob, and see what's unique about it. Because it's the only machine we've got in the collection that comes in standard with a cigarette lighter and ashtray.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
At Microsoft, we don't allow smoking in the buildings anymore.
Anymore, right? But in those days, it was sheer terror to, complete boredom and everything else we were trying to do.
Sure.
And the pointing device was really impressive, too, at its day.
This is like the modern-day equivalent of the mouse?
And you know, that was a light... This is called a light gun.
It was a light gun.
The other way that people did it was a light pen. And so they were pens that you pick up the same thing.
Wow. Now over here we have some of the early memory.
Yeah, these are a collection of sort of early interesting memory devices. And had we had seen before, this was the delay line memory that this one came from English Electric Deuce. This is a millisecond of mercury there, and so there was a bit every microsecond, and so you had 1,000 bits. 1,000 bits were stored in that that line.
And these are the beginning of the core.
Yeah,
over here?
Yeah, these were, these lasted for just a short time. These were the things called Williams tubes. These were CRTs where you wrote on the face and the phosphor stored the bits, and then you'd come back, read those again, and pick off the whether there was charge there or not, and then restore that charge. So this was one of the early storage devices. And then this was the beginning of.
Now these have little magnetic
there's
cores.
Yeah, there's donuts in each of those.
Sorry.
We got him. Close. We got him. We got him.
Okay. It's extremely delicate.
Okay. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. He knows it.
Anyway.
Saying I'm sorry isn't good enough once you've damaged it.
Okay. It didn't touch it, John. Relax.
Yeah. I was 25 feet away.
I can see him right here.
I didn't see you.
Okay, anyway.
I saw
people are very... John's one of the docents, and so we care... the important thing is we care a lot about the artifacts. You've just seen a great demo.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I caused him a minor fuss. I'm sorry. I was being careful not to touch it.
So how did these cores work? Well, they're at the there's an X plane and a Y plane.
Yeah.
And what you do is if you put current down the X and Y, it flips a core to say a 1.
Yep.
The way you prevent a core from being flipped is there's a thing called an inhibit line that threads that. So there's another line that inhibits that. So if you put current in that line, then it doesn't add. So you have 1 and 1 and a minus 1, and that gets you, it doesn't flip.
Okay.
And then the way it's read out, there's another line. So there's actually 3 or 4 wires in there. I think these are probably all 4 wires. The first thing you do is you pulse the X and Y, and then a current is induced on a sense line.
Right.
So you pick out the bit on that sense.
Okay.
And in a sense, it's not very much different than modern CCD memories, where you basically use the same XY selection. And that was invented.
It's a lot bigger.
Yeah.
It's a lot bigger.
And these generate a lot of heat, right?
Because there's a fair amount of energy to drive all that.
Right. And how one of these squares, which is about, you can see.
I think those are 64 by 64. So it's 4. Those are 4,000 bits in each one of those.
4,000 bits.
Bits.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
And, a few less than were on the original Macintosh, right?
Yeah, in fact,
it's just a few.
Right, exactly.
Wasn't much in there.
Yeah, that's when you every instruction counts.
Well, the original Macintosh had 128?
64K RAM.
What's it, 64K?
Of RAM. 128K RAM.
Okay, yeah. Right.
And then we swapped them out for 512.
Yeah. That's when I got into it.
I think that my first Mac was...
I learned to wait for version 2.
I can't remember what it was.
Waited for 512.
Yeah.
He knew it was coming.
I knew
he was predicting the future.
Yeah. I know the Mac, and I like to say the Mac, when I first used it, saved my life. It, we had a project going at Arden, or not Arden, Encore.
Yeah.
We were, project, very complicated project. I think we've got, maybe have one of the boards here, one of the computers. And the project was hopelessly out of control. And so I had heard, there's this program called Mac Project.
Yeah.
So I drove up to New Hampshire, got myself a Mac, came down, and I started putting the project in the machine. Sort of Saturday morning, I took it in on Monday, and I said, "You got to do that. We've got to get this project under control." And so, by the time we finished it, we had a whole room full. We almost broke Mac Project.
That was a lost opportunity, because Project was really, I thought, the best application of the bunch that came out originally, and it never got marketed.
Yeah.
It could have been the Yellow Pages solution for all the little plumbing contractors. I mean, everyone that wanted to buy a computer, because you couldn't do it with an Apple II.
Yeah,
you certainly couldn't use an Apple II like you could use a Mac, right?
Oh, yeah.
And there was nothing
Mac
else out there.
Mac, but I remember doing it.
I remember that.
And
cool. And let's keep walking.
So we got the project got under control from the thing, but it was sort of hopelessly screwed up.
So we got the Google code jam going on here.
This is right. Okay. Okay.
Lots
anyways.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And
don't worry about it. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
It was wrong for me to get too close. So.
These are the beginning of these are the early transistorized machines. So, and then here, sort of, we're in a transition, 1960s transition, where essentially everything went from vacuum tubes to transistorized computers, and then you got all these languages being created at that in 1960.
Hey, where's Dave? Dave! Here's our software.
No.
We have a huge software question. Yeah, okay, so you see in this room artifacts, okay, yeah. And which are systems, and the inventors that designed them and built them, okay, plus the people who ran software. In addition, aside from that, we have a huge collection of software. We're a collecting museum for software.
Yeah.
In fact, I think we're the only one that is actually overtly is really going after a lot of different software, save the code itself.
Well, we have a little library up in Redmond where we have some of the original tapes.
Yeah, but the trick is going to be to make it run, preserve it, and have the source code, have the stories.
I mean, that's what I'm really trying to do at Microsoft is go around with this little camera and try to preserve the stories of how this stuff was made.
And Microsoft has been helping us actually very well. We've got a version of 4K Basic and the 8K Basic. We had an 8K Basic code that came in here, was all annotated by a donor. He didn't know whether or not he could donate it. We got Microsoft Gordon and some
and Microsoft
Roy were helping us do this, and then we got the really guy inside Microsoft that was really helping us a lot. So I think there's a lot of things that are, it needs a lot of collaboration for people to break some of these things loose.
Well, and this is part of the problem of
John, we need Lisp in there too, because 1960, it turns out 1960 was a significant year.
So we're actually going after the project to get all of the Lisp code that exists. Okay, there's a project under the Software Collections Committee, Bernard's committee, that we're doing things. Okay, and one of the things on the table is to really go after, because there is a finite amount of Lisp code in the world.
Yeah.
Right?
True.
This is an important decade, I think, for the museum, because a lot of the people who built this stuff are still alive, right? And in 10 or 20 more years,
that's why it's important.
New biology.
I'm not holding out my hope.
We restore people to
I'm not signing up for that beta test. I'll beta test other things. We're what, into the 1960s now?
Yeah, this is 60. I think this was introduced in 60, 61. This was kind of the workhorse machine for both. It's an offline machine for printing and all of that, but it was also the workforce calculator for small businesses, or actually big businesses.
We'll have to show them the real restoration. We're doing a restoration of a 1401, not this one, another one.
This was a huge effort.
And how many hours does a restoration of a computer this size take?
The 1620 took the better part of a year and a half. A team of about six to 40 people. Every other weekend, they spent time working on it. The PDP-1, which was in reasonably good shape because it was working in Boston, but it's still
they had
about seven or eight people, really stellar people.
People who had actually worked on the machine.
Exactly.
And
that's been going on about 8 months. The 1401 is more complicated because it's so mechanical. When you put all the machinery together, we got people that used to be customer engineers on stuff, and we got a team of about 25 people now that are in different teams and have partitioned themselves for tape drives, the processors and the printers.
We didn't talk about some of the mechanical, I'm not sure if you have any here, but like the railroad here in Santa Clara has a mechanical computer that was built in the early 1900s that ran the railroad yard there. And it has all the algorithms are mechanical. Yeah. So you pull out a switch and it says, if this line is closed, open this one. You know, and I think it's Silicon Valley's first computer, but you can't bring it here to the museum because
like
it's in a building on the railroad.
Things like that would be good.
Yeah, film on that. That would be.
Yeah,
that would
some
be
pictures
great.
Up on
yeah,
the
that would be great to have. And then the other things, there was a lot of calculating being done with totalizers, though, for calculation, and so that was a big deal too for racehorses.
Yeah, the Railroad Museum Historical Society is preserving that, and it worked up through the 60s, and so it worked from 1930 to 60.
This sort of illustrates some of the importance of Livermore or the National Labs in terms of getting driving technology. This is this turns out to be a terabit memory. So it's a bit. It's stored in film. And in fact, that mechanism there, which IBM created, is a miniature automatic developing machine. And so you basically
film develop. Now this is film. This is like photography.
Yeah,
film.
Yeah, photographic film, and then
show you exactly what kind of.
I don't dare touch it.
I shouldn't be doing this either. But
yeah, he shouldn't be doing it. We won't tell anybody, John.
Well, so. We can do one of these. I'm authorized. I'm authorized to do one.
So how many now? How many bits are on here?
On any one? Oh, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, because this looks like a core memory, but it looks like one of those core memories, but really miniaturized.
But think of those in these kind of trays. The trays were put in these racks, and then robotically they could actually be retrieved in a system.
Right, so there was a robotic arm. There was a robotic arm that came and picked up a film.
I mean, there was a huge machine system. We don't have the whole system here, okay, of how it actually used. And this was the process that was used to actually create those.
Yeah.
And of course, then once they got in here, then you had a mechanism by which you could retrieve and read them.
Right. It gets the things.
Yes. Cool. Now this is, what's this?
Man, that's a Twiggy.
That looks like a fan or something, right? But this is a hard disk drive, right?
This is one of the.
This is one of the early hard disks.
One of the early hard disks. Yeah.
From the which one?
ILIAC 4.
ILIAC 4. And how?
How about 10 megabytes worth on these platters that sit inside these?
10 megabytes on this thing, right?
Roughly about.
Now that's, but see, that's way advanced over the original original one.
We can show them a copy. We can show them a real RAMAC later on when we get into the
detail. Okay, we do have the first, and that was. First RAMAC, and that was designed right here in Silicon Valley, and
that belongs to the Magnetic Disk Heritage Center. Al Hoagland is working with us, okay. And IBM has loaned that here to help complete the restoration before he.
Yeah, IBM just south of here has a hard drive lab, a lab of engineers working on hard drive technologies, right? So, and they still operate up to today. Hitachi owns them now. They all move around. You know?
See that thing at the bottom over there?
Yeah.
That was the first sort of consumer available hard drive. It was a 5 megabyte profile.
And what was the retail price on that?
Which one was that?
That was the profile. It sat on top of a Lisa. It was a 5 megabyte drive. I think it was $34.95 retail.
$34.
For a five megabyte.
Yeah.
They quickly moved to 10, though.
And the average iPod now is $200 and has, you know, gigs.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, 200 gigs, $200, yeah.
And that wasn't necessary upgrade to shipping the Lisa, because we had to goose it up to a mega RAM to ship it, which really killed the price point.
Yeah, right.
That's why you have so many gray hairs, right?
I do.
How am I going to sell something that's so expensive, right?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of them.
These came from Berkeley. This is one of the first RAID controllers, and so this was the idea where you parallel disk and get.
So this is the first RAID controller,
yeah.
And now you can buy this for a couple hundred bucks, right?
Yeah, right. Well, this has disks in there too, but in fact, it's the. Yeah, it was the first.
Don't you have a RAID drive in your car, AJ?
I have a RAID array in my car.
Yeah. Okay.
The experiments actually create what that RAID interface may start to look like. Off the shelf parts, you know, and look at how things could actually be done.
Now, we're in the late 60s, or still the 50s?
Actually, 50s, 60s. We go back a little bit here. These magnetic drums were earlier. Drums sort of went out in that time. This is a couple 1950s drum. This is actually a computer that I programmed on. This was.
You programmed on this one?
Yeah, this was an English.
So was this early in your career?
Yeah, first and last real program I wrote. I think the last one was a HyperCard program sometime.
Did you write HyperCard, really, Gordon?
Oh, yeah.
That was my favorite program as a kid.
Yeah, I regard him as
nice. Let's keep going.
I've done some visual basic programming now.
Right. So we're in an international museum too.
Yeah.
And this is an architect from Germany, Konrad Zuse. And this was one of his first machines. Z3 was built based on relays.
Yeah.
And we've got a Z23 here in its full life in color.
Now, how did the computers developed in Europe differ from the computers developed here in the United States?
Power supply.
Well, that's one.
They were both funded by war efforts.
Yeah.
They were on different sides of the war.
War efforts. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, although there really was very.
The manuals are in different languages, right?
minimal funding of this for the war. Zeus actually ended up doing a lot of special calculators for aerodynamics for the Luftwaffe. And he had made, computers in his apartment in sort of early 1940s. So he was, he would have been considered a major father. And, I think a lot of us consider him a major figure in computing.
Certainly an architect, a great architect.
Yeah.
People have
but he'd been more significant, I think.
Do we want to get into silicon?
No, we want to go this way.
Okay.
Which is, and here we have...
It's a little out of sequence.
A little out of sequence, but anyway, here's a Google's first Google production server, which we're happy
to have. Can see the circuit for it sagging.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So this was the entire Google computer in 7 years ago.
I don't know if it's the entire one. It's probably a section.
It was one of the servers, I think. 30
of these in the first center. Yes. So, in fact, it's a 30th of Google.
Many of the installed PCs never work. That's interesting.
Yeah. So, and, forgive us for being a little out of sequence, but this is the later, this is the transition 1970 transition to integrated circuits. And so we're seeing that movement here. This is one of the first.
This is the circuit. Only one of its kind, so Robert, please get this thing on tape.
Okay.
Yeah, this was a marketing gimmick here.
Marketing gimmick. Neiman Marcus. Here, this was the advertisement in Neiman Marcus. If she could only cook as well as Honeywell can compute.
And they never sold one.
They never sold anything. There was no input output device that we know. You probably stored recipes, and you could only program in binary or octal. We're not really sure how it actually operated, but it's really one of a kind. This Jetson look of the
By the way, we've got to go back here for a second.
Okay.
And this is
talk about the
360. This is probably the
significant.
Here's probably the most significant computer in the whole.
Why do you say that?
Because this was the beginning of IBM and the mainframe. Okay. 1964 introduction. With the 360, and I think this is a Model 30, and so it was a range of computers spanning with a single architecture, and so this was the one of the smallest models, Model 30, and then it went up to Model 91, 95. We happen to have a console from a 95 over there, but anyway, this was. Was the machine. In fact, virtually the whole corporate world still operates.
$1 billion bet. They put the whole company on the line and make a product. And
so this is a bet the computer company on.
And they won. And it is the still 40 years later. We just celebrated the 40th
anniversary. Yeah.
And it's the dominant I'd say large organization computer. So
yeah.
Also, there's an evolution of this System 360 in the back. We'll show you later the 1401 restoration project.
Oh, there's a chart. We can take it
good.
Through that. Yeah, that's good.
Now, how much RAM did this thing have on it? Just to show the
this one has 16K. It says 16K core. I don't know how that's 64 kilobytes.
And they used this until 2001. So that's what the sign says.
They, yeah.
Carnegie Mellon. for analysis of medical data. Yeah.
Old machines tend to be used and reused.
If it's still doing what it...
I actually remember seeing this at school when I first started. So.
Wow. Oh, really?
Okay, this is the first... this is the beginning of the ARPANET and the modern net as we know it today.
The Internet.
The Internet. This is the basic...
This was number 10 at Lincoln Laboratories.
Okay. And... how many of these around the world were there?
Well, it started with two and then three, and then grew a little bit when they had the ARPANET of this scale in this particular machine. But here's a picture of what the whole network world looked like in 1978, and those were the only nodes that existed.
Wow.
And for now it's just been exponential.
And Stanford's here, so exactly. We're real close to Stanford.
Exactly. Yeah. Wow. Exactly.
First packet router for the... the predecessor of the Internet.
Right. Exactly.
Now we get into your territory, George.
Yeah. This is pieces of the first PDP-1. Okay. It had a display, and then it also had a console, a desk console, which I don't think we have, but the subsequent models, we'll show you a subsequent model of how it evolved right after that. And so it was kind of the first, it's the origin of DEC. And then here's a PDP-10, a KL-10, which was a machine that I had worked on, which was the PDP-6, which is the time sharing. It was the first commercial time sharing system. So it was built to handle a large number of users, and then you'd multiplex those in, and then swap users around.
Now, how many users would be connected to this?
Over time, it would get up to several hundred, but at the very beginning, it was a function of how much memory you had and what response time you wanted to give. But typically, people were running 16 to 32 users on it.
And then, how much did one of these cost back in the
these
day?
These were anywhere from about $500,000.
$500,000
yeah,
for one
right.
of these.
Right, yeah.
And today's $200 computer
yeah.
is better.
We'll
than...
do it. Yeah, exactly. Right, we can do the same thing. This is here's the beginning of, this is a PDP-8, and this is the what we... I think of it as the first mini computer.
This is the first mini computer.
Yeah. What PDP? These earlier PDPs were a certain kind. But what was important about this was we treated it as a component,
okay.
So that it was used and embedded in other systems. So we never thought of it as a standalone thing, but rather it was.
Now, when you say mini computer, what was different from a mini computer than say?
This
is considered a mainframe? Or?
This is a mainframe.
And this is a mini.
So
mainframe over here.
Yeah. This is, the way I used to define mini is the smallest computer that you can build to do useful work.
Interesting.
And so you were aiming for price and performance so that you could get these programs to work.
Yep. And this is what, the 60s still?
This one came out in, that machine came out in 64. Yeah. And then it evolved for about, actually there were PDP-8s made models of it, some of these around here.
And what kinds of companies use these? What were they used
they
for?
Were any kind of control application. They were used for message switching, so you would bring in a bunch of telegraph lines, multiplex them in, and then have them go out in another line. You'd use for process control, where sensing a bunch of things and opening and closing a valve, doing set points. In fact, the machine was designed, we designed it, its predecessor, the PDP-5, to control a reactor in Chalk River, Canada. So its job was to sense all of the you know, the
heating and
all of what was going on in the reactor, and then to make sure things didn't blow up.
Yep.
And then over here is the VAX computer.
That's a nice looking machine too.
That was
too.
The first. Yeah, this one came out in '78.
That was number blue.
'78. Yeah. Very, very, very nice. And he, you know, did very well until Deck realized they should be changing what they're doing. But
every researcher on the planet that is worth his or her salt had one.
And I think the first ones were at I think they came in at $250,000. In fact, I was trying to one of the first machines. I got it, made sure it went to, I think the first one or two, serial 2, 3, something like that, went to Carnegie Mellon. And the guy who got it was Popol, and he was a computational chemist. And I bet on him as going to win the Nobel Prize. And in fact, he did about 5 years ago for computational chemistry. I just thought the work was great, you know, and I said, this is the way you do chemistry. And so he was the pioneer of that and got a prize for it.
Wow.
And he'd been running on an 1108. And I said, gee, let's. So when I went there when we first introduced it, and I said, gee, you know, I talked to him. I said, you really got to get one of these things. Let's figure out how to do that. He got, I don't know, serial 2 or 3.
Wow. Did you use one of these?
No.
Anyway. No, I started.
These were the 750s were Berkeley had a ton of those. I mean, we shipped these around. Basically, these were almost treated like these were treated like PCs at one point.
This is what everybody
had.
They really were.
Yeah. So now we get into some of the more modern stuff now.
Well, we've got a few.
We're getting there. We're getting a little ways to go.
Yeah. And then this is Seymour Cray Allen here.
Exactly.
Seymour Cray did all.
This was actually the first one that this NTDS that he was an architect for.
Yeah.
Okay, which looks like this big hunk of machinery that you could close up and throw overboard and make you stay dry. But look at the modular technology, because that sort of followed the pattern in his next iterations. And then he went and produced Joint Control Data Corporation. This was where Little Character was a laboratory prototype that ultimately became a real product. Okay, and I guess that's Control Data off in terms of real products. And then the ones that he's most famous for are the real supercomputers. The big supercomputer, the 6600, all right, for example.
That was his first
1964.
Look at the wiring work on this. I mean,
it's incredible.
Yeah.
Just incredible.
I can't imagine wiring this up and keeping track of
the
world.
Or the design, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, see, each of those are cut to length.
Yeah.
Just so that the timing all worked
and
out.
And he was able to eliminate the level of logic as a result of that, okay? So he could run faster and faster without being promulgated. And then they formed Cray Research, okay? And the Cray 1 became the real icon of supercomputing, fast processors.
And this thing was filled with Freon, right?
Exactly. This was cool.
I remember when Apple Computer they bought one of these in the early 80s, right?
Yeah.
And it was such a big deal that they had it on the front page of the Mercury News. I still remember that.
Yeah. You've heard the old story of Seymour and Steve Jobs talking to each other, and Steve said to Seymour, Seymour, I just bought a Cray to do my next design. And Seymour said, yes, I just bought a Macintosh to do mine. Yeah. But liquid cooled, cooling got to be a real problem for these things. Okay, that's what allowed you to really go. And this was the Cray 2 that you see behind you.
Now inside these would be hundreds of circuit boards, or
exactly simple, reasonably simple kinds of modules. Okay, that he was kind of his style of design. He tried to keep that small number. The power supply was all around it. That's why they call it the world's greatest love seat.
And these were not seats. They did not want you to sit on
these. That's where the power
supply was underneath it.
So they were probably pretty warm seats.
Of course, it was conversion. They had the whole power system and the whole cooling was a building unto itself. If you So you looked at this and you said, boy, that's simple. And then you go outside and there's a big MG set that drove this. It's like these were 120 kilowatts, I believe.
Now, this thing was filled with Freon. What happens if a board died or some part in here had a problem and you had to replace a board?
Well, Freon was inert. But in fact, it didn't go through the boards.
No, this one did.
The plate, there was a cooling plate, and it went through that. In fact, it's similar to the 6600. In fact, each one of these sections had its own
Freon system,
heat exchanger. Yeah, it's really. So you brought in chilled water, and then that was converted to cold plate, and so the Freon circulated, and then you carried it out. And so there was a big cooling tower. By the way, which is hugely efficient compared to what we do today. I mean, when we've gone to the supercomputers of today are made with lots of PCs, and they're all air-cooled.
Yep.
And the air cooling is comparatively inefficient. And if you go to Los Alamos, you'll see these stacks, these cooling tower stacks.
Even at Microsoft, we can't add more computers to some of our labs because we've tapped out the air conditioning.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah. If you're in, we have a room with a HP Superdome computer, which has 2,500 hard drive, and you stand underneath the air conditioning, it is just freezing. It's just blowing air as fast as it can get in there.
So Seymour's second machine was more like you described before. This was like an aquarium.
Yeah.
So all the circuit boards were immersed in fluid this time.
Okay.
In a fluid called fluorinert. And then, of course, you had to have a place to recirculate the fluid. Now, then you might ask, well, what happens when a circuit board goes bad? Well, they had to have special engineering designs, different timing considerations, so that when they drain the fluid, you wouldn't burn the thing up when you tried to test it again.
Yeah, they had a low power test mode, right?
Exactly, exactly right.
Was there a pulse test?
Exactly. Yeah. So it was a total engineering challenge to be able to do that. And it was a marvelous machine to see in operation.
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing it at this one at Livermore. And then over here, this is where all the conversion of cooling of the foreigner took place. So it was sitting there bubbling.
And then some of
you look at this as sort of a fishbowl. Yeah, it's kind of you expected to see fish.
And I don't know of any place in the world you can see all of these Cray machines.
Yeah, I don't either.
There really isn't. Yeah. This is part of a Cray 3 brick. 93.
Just look at all the wires and keeping track of that.
The size of the wire. And where
of course, when you talk to the Intel guys now, they have all that wiring in one little tiny chip.
Right, exactly. And then there were a few machines here that were, this is a thing that was called a Crayette, which is a
Crayette.
Convex. Yeah, because it used the vector architecture design and then basically a small version of that. So
how much more powerful would be one of the Cray machines than one of the DEC machines you built?
They in a way they were different because the Cray was very good on vector. So you could do like maybe 50 times more. But then if the thing weren't vectorizable, why then it would be like three or four times difference. And so essentially VAX, when I went to NSF in 85 or 86, why people said, you're the guy who destroyed supercomputing, because what happened was all of the scientific users were buying VAXs, running them themselves versus getting a Cray or running on time sharing on a Cray.
Now, when you say vector, what did you mean by
vector? I mean there's an instruction that says if I want to multiply a vector a sub I, 100 elements to another 100 elements, I can do that in one instruction. And that's done in a pipelined fashion so that you multiply each element, but that's single instruction. So this stuff, you treat a vector as a data element as opposed to a scalar, which a single element, which you normally do.
Right.
And then this is the beginning of of the end of, this is the beginning of the end of Cray computing, or Cray-style computing.
Because and there's an Intel logo on here.
Well, this is this is actually the second machine. We have the first machine, I believe. This is Chuck Seitz's machine.
Exactly. Yeah,
we
got a piece of that.
Yeah, and the Chuck Seitz at Caltech made a. I'm trying to think of the name, but
Cosmic Cube.
Yeah, 64. Basically, each one of those is a plain old PC, and then these are all wired together. This is probably 32, I suspect it looks like. And that these are all connected together in an array in this hypercube array. So you can see it there. And then each were computers, and they were all programmed together to do parallel stuff. And then that was the beginning of the end of large machines, but switching to commodity machines, and these were.
And this is the semiconductor era now, right? Coming in. Because I see a famous name, Fairchild, over there. Obviously, we saw Intel on this machine.
We're starting.
Yeah.
To really, really use. This is where parallel processing, highly massively parallel computing. Danny Hillis designed this. 1024 single processor that were trying to communicate with each other.
Right. This is a, in a sense, this didn't. This didn't take off at the time because, in fact, it's there are several machines like this in there, including the ELIAC 4 next door, or right next to it. And that was that basically you had one instruction, and then you just had to replicate that on 64 pieces of data or 64,000 pieces of data. So the problem when you do that is you get into one of Amdahl's laws, which said says if you've got a serial part and a parallel part, why the time is determined by the serial part.
Yep.
Anyway, should we go?
We're getting into your neighborhood.
Now we want to go.
Let's go into the
PC area.
Right. Yeah, because we'd like to get some of those stories.
Yeah, exactly.
Is David still around, or is he?
I don't know where David is.
Okay. Yeah.
He's playing chess.
Oh, okay.
He's playing chess.
Yeah, we got to see the whole chess area, too. All right, we'll cut tape here and walk over to the new. All right, so actually, before we get into the PCs, isn't that the first laser printer over here?
Oh, yeah. This is...
We actually interviewed the guy who invented this, Gary Starkweather.
Yeah,
in fact, his picture's right there.
Yeah, Gary's...
he invented this at Xerox PARC, right?
Yeah, that's right. And then another thing that came out of PARC was this was a machine that was the paint machine, so the first paint machine, and that was also done.
And you guys have the first Utah, the real Utah teapot.
Yeah.
Which, if you're a graphic student, you used that to make 3D renderings.
First demo of 3D rendering. I think actually we ought to look at some of the first. I'm trying to think where the first PCs are, and then I'd like to.
Do you have an Altair?
Oh yeah, we've got Altairs. Let's see, Altair, Commodore, what are
in the corner.
Let's do that and then let Dan'll go take that and let him go into the real PC stuff, which he knows.
And you guys have an Apple One.
Okay, here. Yeah, actually.
There you go.
Signed by Buzz. All right.
Small number of those.
Yeah. And these are worth probably $40,000 to $50,000 now, right?
How much are they going for now? We've heard
30 to 40, I think.
Yeah, so it was good. Well, this is the Altair, and then what else? And then there's the Commodore should be around.
Yeah, Mark McDonald, the first Microsoft employee, told me about how they built BASIC for this device, right?
Yeah.
And that's why they started the company down in Albuquerque.
Right, that was the one.
Because this company was in Albuquerque,
right?
Who was the guy who started this company? John
Ed,
Roberts?
Ed,
or
Roberts, yeah, I think it was
John.
Was it John
Ed
or
Roberts.
Was it Ed Roberts?
Roberts.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Ed.
Actually, Wall is really easy to talk from because they're sort of chronologically organized here.
Sure.
So you can see the Altair and the Commodore.
Oh, yeah. They're all compare and contrast things.
This is my first computer, the Apple II. Which had a beautiful design.
Did you have a 2E?
I had
upper and lower case.
We had We had one of the original 2s and the 2E and the 2 Plus.
So you have an 80 column card in it, so you could display.
My dad had a CPU card in it and an 80 column card.
Were you running Apple DOS or CPM? Because CPM was the most popular operating system for that machine.
He was running CPM. I was playing games on the thing. You know, so I only cared if I could stick it in Shoplifter and get that to boot up. So someday we'll talk to Waz about it.
You know, there was a lot of money in stands that went over this so you could put a monitor on top.
Yeah.
Don't forget to get the Xerox Alto. Gotta get the
Alto. Xerox?
That's a two. But that was the most important machine.
I actually built a few hundred of these things. So my mom belonged to Hilde Licht's company, and they ran out of factory capacity to build the Apple IIs because they were so popular. Uh-huh. So here in the Valley, a bunch of housewives built the motherboards at home, and I made a few bucks of motherboard, and I got paid allowance to load them up and hand the board over to my mom, who would solder them.
Ancient apples,
and they were beautiful motherboards. I don't know if you can actually. Someday we're going to go and see Waz and have him show you the motherboard. But his motherboard had fewer failures on the soldering lines because of the way it was designed.
Ooh,
yeah,
he
was very elegant.
He had flashes of brilliance there, right? The disk drive controller was his big deal. And another guy named Rob Wolf did a lot of that.
Now, when did you join Apple? You joined after the Apple II era, right?
I did join after the Apple II.
I mean, it was Apple's big business when you joined, right? The Mac team was...
by a long shot, and it was Apple's big business.
And it was... The Mac team was controversial in Apple, right?
Well, when I started, the Mac wasn't in existence yet. The Lisa project was underway. And the Apple III was going through the recall process more or less at that time. So I started right after the IPO. The company went public in December of 80.
Yeah.
And it was a pretty good sized company, $100 million in revenue. And but still, you know.
But not everybody at Apple believed in the Macintosh, right? There were
In the early stage?
Yeah.
I would say no. I think a lot of people felt like the Lisa was going to be the savior, if you will, as the next generation focused on business. But two things. Price point was pretty high, although a lot less than at the time it was the star that was doing well in the market, or reasonably well for Xerox in terms of pioneering work. But the biggest question was whether the developer community was going to come along, and the Lisa had a hard time because they had built a suite of applications in-house that made it difficult for anyone to commit to write application software for the machine.
Anders Halsberg, who worked at Borland at that time, told me that we took him through the Microsoft Museum, and he saw a Macintosh there. And,
Brad Silverberg worked on the Lisa stuff.
And he said he actually had to write code for the Macintosh on a Sun machine and then port it over. Because the early prototypes, I guess, didn't have enough RAM or enough space.
Well, the development machine for the Mac was a Lisa. There may have been some early stuff that was required on a Sun machine. And because Wayne Rosing was there, there were a lot of access in-house, too. That was a big, the Lisa project was really the big project, and the Mac team was able to take pieces from them, but then obviously redesign all the hardware and the software and compartmentalize things into the world.
Now, while I was an Apple guy, actually, I was an Apple II guy, Microsoft and the whole DOS world was starting to take off with the PC, right?
The PC
came in the world in 82, right?
Yeah, I think it was in the fall of 82.
Do you have an original? Yeah, right there. Yeah,
there's a PC.
81, 82.
Oh, yeah, I guess it was 81.
Yeah.
I
remember when IBM came in the market, Apple ran a full-page ad in the Mercury News saying, welcome IBM to our world.
Seriously. Yeah. Welcome IBM, seriously.
Right.
Yeah, right.
I remember that. I read.
You know what the strategy was for that?
What's that?
Regis McKenna was really the marketeer that drove a lot of the thinking. And the premise was like Hertz, where they said, we try harder, and we're number two. To Hertz, excuse me. And that was all about basically positioning yourself as number two. in the early, early days, although Apple was had market share lead. Yeah. But it was a way to get out in front of all the other companies, because as you look around here, there were dozens and dozens and dozens of companies building machines, all of which were equally capable, some maybe technically superior. I couldn't be a judge of that. But
Well, certainly we had fights at school about whether the Commodore was better than the Apple II or whether the Trash 80.
I just wanted to play video games.
Even later on, Atari built that brilliant machine that everybody loved. And I forget which one it was that had all the graphics capability.
I think it was the 800?
The Amiga.
The Amiga. Yeah, that was a beautiful. Yeah. Everybody loved that. Exactly.
I used that in the TV studio when I was in college, too.
The Amiga was...
Is that an Amiga? No, that's not an Amiga.
Let's see. I'm sure there's one in here
Probably one around.
There's certainly an early Atari kind of game there.
Yeah.
But that was like a...
Yeah, there was an immense amount of... Apple did a lot with the developer community that really made a difference. There was a division of the company called SDS, stood for Special Delivery Software, and hobbyists and programmers sent their programs in for evaluation, and as long as it sort of booted and ran and worked, and then things got sold in little Ziploc baggies, believe it or not, they were, I don't know, 10 or 15 bucks or whatever, and sort of like a shareware kind of collective thing. This whole division was, you know, there to vet things and, again, make sure they worked. And the OS came on every floppy, actually, which was also interesting as well, because these machines didn't, you know, you remember that.
Oh, yeah. Hey, I started with tapes, with cassette tapes. We had to push play on the tape to load up our machines.
Now, the Sun 1, that was an interesting machine, too.
Yeah. So when did you start in this world?
My first computer was an Apple II Plus, and I moved up from an Apple II Plus to a 386-16. Then I went to a Pentium II. So I took big leaps and bounds, and I always used Macs in school, and one of my favorite programs was HyperCard.
But now your car runs on Windows CE, right?
No, it's actually running Windows XP right now. Windows XP. The deployed version will be running Windows CE and maybe a few other things as
Someday we're going to get a tape of your car.
You could even do that today, Robert.
All right. We'll go out there in a minute. So anything else we should know about the museum and about... this is just a very small percentage of the museum.
Well,
we've spent 2 hours.
We've gone through a lot of history here. And so
now, on site here is only a fraction of what the museum actually owns, right?
Well, there's a back room that's got
the back room.
Yeah, we might give you a secret tour if you're lucky.
We should do a once over.
Okay.
Actually, what's not here, we ought to show you what I consider the first personal computer.
What's that?
That's this thing called the Link, laboratory instrument computer.
Okay.
And there were about 20 or about 40 of them made. They were made by a bunch of doctors, neurologists, among other people that were using for instrumentation and essentially all the first biomedical stuff, and that came out in around 63, 64, and it had two displays. It had had lots of places to connect instruments to it, and then it had two tape units. So tape units that were replaceable. Unlike the tape units, the cassettes you use, these were real. They had real file systems on them because you could replace the blocks. So
cool.
We had to go look at that, and then John probably ought to give you we could take a quickie through the back room.
There's a pole behind.
Yeah. And hey, John, let's go. Let's make a absolute quick pass down the aisles of the back room. Okay. I want to say, okay, what's not?
Well, I just took dental sum back there.
Yeah. Cool. I say what's not here is, you know, I say
I get a whole picture of
the. We should show him the Link, which is the first PC.
I'll be on that list very shortly.
All right.
So you saw less than 10% of what we had in the collection, and this is the back room.
This is the secret back room. First seen on TV, right?
So the half, the half, the other half. Yeah. Let me turn the lights on for you, Bob.
All right.
Lights, yeah.
Probably the lights.
Yeah. He's good to have all this stuff.
What's that?
I saw the first Apple computer.
You saw the first Apple computer? Yeah.
The one with the gay design.
Yeah.
So we have documents coming in all the time. There's videotapes. There's pictures, everything else, all of which were... You got it. And an archivist and volunteers are kind of systematically trying to go through this.
Perfect.
And get as much of that in line as we possibly can. But it's a very, very labor-intensive...
And you have all sorts of documentation.
Yeah, exactly. Which, technical documentation, letters, papers, it's a variety of things.
15 or so, what do we estimate, about 15 million pages of...
Yeah, 15 to 19 million pages of stuff. Yeah. Okay, and this goes on. We've got some very unique things here.
What you guys have written back there?
And then this side are all the small artifacts, if you will.
Yeah.
So we put these on shelves on this side of the building. And eventually this will become exhibit space. Okay, this stuff will go off-site. We lend these to different museums.
Just get some sense of the scale of what your collection is.
The scale is something else.
I mean, this is a real treat because I've never been back here before.
And you know, we've got these little stations you see down at the end of the row here. Our volunteers and our curatorial staff go through here. They're taking pictures of everything. So if you go on a website now, you can see all these things now coming online.
Yeah.
And information about them. It also includes ephemera, so we have things like coffee cups, you know, hats, shoes, you know, things that you can maybe ultimately use in kind of an exhibit space. So it's a lot of fun things here too, in addition to the real serious artifacts that we're collecting.
I donated some Channel 9 guys, by the way, to the museum.
PC Junior. It's a guide to a PC Junior.
There you go.
You gotta love that, the little chiclet keyboard.
I know it. My dad bought one of those, and he loved this, right? I tried to convince him not to buy it. It was like a week after he bought it. They said, close it down.
Oh, that's so funny.
That's I had to compete amazing. Against the PC Junior.
Did you?
Yeah.
Candy from a
baby. I know.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't even close. And so these are all the small things. And then on the other side, let me take you to the other side.
This commander controller, I used to have one of those.
Yeah. I still do in my basement.
Is this heaven for geeks? Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe it's hell, too. So we remember all the mistakes we made.
So the other half on this side are all the larger artifacts.
Yeah.
Okay, that we're storing. And again, these will be used in exhibits, lent to other museums. So it takes a lot of space. It costs a lot to kind of keep all this kind of operation going.
Yeah.
And this is another piece of a Cray 1. There's an incredible part of your deck collection back in here.
Gordon?
I actually haven't been back here yet. Symbolics machine.
Yeah.
Symbolics. This is Bill Daly's jelly bean machine that he did at MIT. He's now a professor over at Stanford.
This is an original Mac box.
That's what I thought, but I didn't see it. West chastised me when I saw him. Here it is. Okay.
There you go.
Okay, this...
Let me put the light on.
Yeah, that'd be great, because it's a little bit hard to see in here.
It's a little bit hard to see this one, but...
Much better.
Okay, now, these were the console parts of the link. So actually, I'm sorry, there was only one display. That, and there was a keyboard, and then these were the stores. Namely, those were things called link tape. DEC actually took those over, made a copy or slightly different version of it called DEC tape, and that was a dominant storage for maybe 10 years from 65 to 75, 80 or something.
pre-floppy. So when the floppy came in, then deck tape went out. But fundamentally, it was the thing you could put in your pocket. You could always depend that it would be readable, because there were two channels per bit. I mean, and these were ored together, analog ored together. Or so you basically you could actually punch a hole in the tape and read from the other.
Really?
Yeah. So it was very highly reliable.
Well, this is a good place to end because we're almost out of tape.
Good.
Wow. Yeah, thank you so much, guys. Thanks to AJ for getting us this tour. And we'll come and see your car in a little while. I think I have another tape in my bag.
Yeah, right.
And thanks, Daniel,
Robert,
for giving me some of the early Apple and next history. And thanks for spending some time showing us this great museum. And thank you very much for saving the stuff for all of us.
Great.
Yeah. Thanks
for having us. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Because this is a great museum.
Come back, and we'll show you the Jess
exhibit.
Showing you the newest exhibit we opened up.
Let me see if I have another tape. But,
see if you do. Go look at the car, and then John, the Jess exhibit is just...
That's a different exhibit technique we're using.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Gordon, to you and your wife for saving all this stuff. Because if it wasn't for somebody like you who saved this stuff, we wouldn't have this history to teach
so
people where it came from.
Just get rid of this guy.
Gone in a flash.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's the thing that we were talking about.
Thanks.
Great.